While many in South Africa were sleeping last night, Donald Trump had a surprise, not a very pleasant one. We are going to see tariffs on South African goods into the United States of 30% starting 1 August. Well, is it true? Isn't it true? South Africa was one of three countries that was highlighted by the U.S. president in his announcement. Joel Pollack, senior editor with Breitbart, joins us to give us context on what's going on. Hi, Joel. You're in Washington, D.C. Early morning for you. Once again, thank you for helping us through and to understand here in South Africa. We really are being rocked by lots of problems in the country at the moment. Our president, however, is sitting in Rio de Janeiro, which I suppose is par for the course when you are a little deranged, a little far away from the action. But bring us up to date, if you would, for what many South Africans would have missed last night, your President Donald Trump in the White House.
Well, on Monday, the 7th of July, President Trump raised tariffs on 14 countries as a punitive measure for failing to negotiate, he felt, in reasonable good faith toward a trade deal. And he also said that BRICS countries, including South Africa, with what he called anti-American policies, would be charged an additional 10% tariff. So I assume that means you might actually see tariffs of 40%, not 30%, although I'm not sure if the 10% is included in the 30%. I'm trying to figure that out as we speak, but it does seem that you're going to pay an additional 10% surcharge because of what he calls anti-American policies. So there you go. So it's 40%, actually, not 30%.
Okay, because the number that's being reported by the FT and elsewhere is 30%. So that 10% tariff hasn't yet been worked in, but he did send a letter. And if I can just bring that letter up onto the screen, which, of course, this being South Africa, everybody's seen the letter already. The one part of it that does give a little bit of hope is right towards the end, where he says that we will perhaps consider an adjustment to this letter. These tariffs may be modified upward or downward depending on our relationship with your country. It is in here as well that he is going to be, the 30% is quite clearly stated there twice. However, as you mentioned, the BRICS, the additional 10% for BRICS could still come into play. Yo, Joel, what's caused all of this? At some point, it wasn't long ago that they were sitting in the White House with a great opportunity to get South Africa on the right page.
Well, you and I spoke after that meeting, and I told you that I believe that South African President Cyril Ramaphosa had achieved exactly nothing. It came away with nothing. That the South African government and the generally very government-friendly media in South Africa had created this idea that the most important thing to do in this meeting was to argue with Trump. So Ramaphosa did that. And the story that the South African media told was that Ramaphosa had done very well. He had called out Trump's misinformation. But the story in the American media was very different, which was that Ramaphosa had looked foolish, that President Trump had presented irrefutable evidence that racism and genocidal language, at least, was tolerated in the South African political system. And both sides told themselves different stories, but the point of the entire meeting was to reach some kind of compromise on trade and other issues. The only progress seemed to have been made by the Minister of Communications in South Africa, who mentioned possibly allowing Starlink to invest in South Africa using empowerment equivalents rather than BEE quotas. And that was shot down by the ANC government and seemed to have gone nowhere. I'm not sure where that is at the moment, but there really seemed to have been no progress. And Ramaphosa didn't come with any sort of a plan or any kind of compromises. You and I had spoken for many weeks about the kinds of compromise that the administration wanted to see. None of that was on the table. And then adding insult to injury, there is the fact that South Africa sided with Iran in the recent 12-day war. And although some people in the South African government made some positive noises about peace in the Middle East or about caring about civilians on both sides. The fact is that the deputy foreign minister went to the Iranian embassy in Pretoria and signed a book of condolence after the war when the United States had attacked the nuclear sites of the Iranian regime and when the Iranian regime had attacked civilians in Israel with hundreds of missiles. So clearly the South Africans were on Iran's side, and that did not go unnoticed by the administration. So in addition to announcing the 30% duty, Trump said that countries that follow the anti-American policies of the BRICS alliance will face an additional 10% tariff. So that's where we are. There was nothing forthcoming from the South African government in terms of compromise, and so there is a 30%, perhaps 40% tariff.
Is President Trump wanting to achieve with South Africa, given this hardline attitude of the ANC and the fact that the people of South Africa are going to be hurt by this? What's his intention here? Or has he even thought that far, given that it's such a small little blip on the radar of the US's trade operations?
Well, I think he's simply trying to achieve a much better trade situation, one in which the South African government lowers non-tariff and tariff barriers to trade. We've spoken at length about some of the non-tariff barriers, like BEE policies, like the land policies that the government has undertaken this year with the signing of the Expropriation Act and so forth. I think Trump has made it pretty clear what he wants. And South Africa, for some reason, has not made any move in his direction. So the result is a higher tariff. And if you look at other countries, the other 13 facing stiff tariff increases, these are countries that haven't taken the threat of tariff increases seriously enough. Now, there are countries that have sat down with the president and have tried to work things out. And if you look at the UK, for example, there's a trade deal where the UK really didn't give very much, but managed to head off this impending tariff increase. And if you look at what's happening this week in Washington, Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel is visiting again, and the Israeli government is trying to do whatever it can to avoid any kind of commercial conflict or confrontation with the United States, especially because of the important military alliance and the Israeli dependence on American weapons and so forth. But basically, Trump wants people to work with him. And for some reason, South Africa has resisted that. So that's why we are where we are.
The whole BRICS story with an additional 10%, what came out of that BRICS meeting that would have aggravated him so much? And I ask this because when you look at who was there or who wasn't there, it's perhaps more important. President Key wasn't there. President Putin wasn't there. The Saudis didn't send anybody senior. There were foreign ministers only from Iran and so on. So apart from Cyril Lula, the host, and Modi from India, it wasn't really a high-powered event, and yet it's got a very, very strong reaction from the U.S. president.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what it was that made him react in that way, but you know, in terms of South Africa, I mean, South Africa's influence has not been positive, and the idea that South Africa is non-aligned really has taken a hit because South Africa is clearly aligned with Iran, and Iran is one of the worst regimes in the world. I mean, there's no way of sugarcoating it. The Iranian regime attacked civilians in the closing hours of the war before the ceasefire kicked in. The Iranians fired a missile that killed a family in Israel. They fired a missile at a hospital, which, you know, miraculously didn't kill anyone because the hospital had evacuated that building the day before. But, you know, this is not a regime you want to really be friendly with. So why BRICS even allowed them into the alliance is a mystery to me. And the alliance really hasn't achieved very much. I mean, major countries are staying away from the meetings now, as you've pointed out. And I don't think there's any real prospect of a kind of currency union. You know, when the war broke out, people retreated to the U.S. dollar. They didn't retreat to other currencies. I don't think that BRICS is really a threat, even though the Trump administration is taking it seriously as one. So I don't know what South Africa is achieving. You know, the right thing to do, I think the smart thing to do, is to drop some of these rogue states as allies. They don't do anything for South Africa. They might sort of on an individual or partisan level fill a few people's pockets or some party coffers somewhere. And one day we'll probably find out exactly who. But I don't think it's helpful to South Africa. It's not helpful to the South African people, and certainly not helpful to relations with the United States.
Joel, you know South African history very well. In 1948, Jan Smuts lost the election because he was spending too much time abroad. At the moment, there's a lot happening in this country. You might not have followed the bombshell expose from the head of the police in KwaZulu-Natal on the political assassination unit, which has been doing really well in tracking people down, is now being attempted to be disbanded by the ANC government. So there's that on the one side. You've got the threat of a no-confidence vote being aired by the Democratic Alliance. And even within the ANC, they're talking about calling or recalling, potentially recalling Cyril Ramaphosa, as they've done before. It does have parallels here of what happened to Jan Smuts in 1948, playing on a global stage and not paying attention to what's happening locally. Now add on these tariffs. My word, the pressure's got to be mounting.
Well, you know, Jan Smuts had been around for many decades before that happened. And there was a clear opposition force that was ready to challenge him. He lost his own constituency. At that time, South Africa had constituency elections. And look, maybe the ANC is feeling the heat from the Democratic Alliance and other opposition parties. I'm not sure if the analogy really holds. I mean, has Cyril Ramaphosa achieved on the world stage what Jan Smuts did? I mean, Jan Smuts helped found the League of Nations and was a big player in the United Nations and had helped recognize the State of Israel, helped really just build the post-war infrastructure. So he really was a key player in a way that I don't think Ramaphosa is. I mean, Ramaphosa is sort of welcomed at photo opportunities, but I don't think people really feel there's any kind of productivity in the partnership with him. I don't think he's boosted South Africa's profile. Jan Smuts really, as they say, punched above his weight class. I mean, when Jan Smuts arrived at the Paris talks in 1919, to end the First World War, he brought with him South Africa's achievements in that war, as did the Australians and the New Zealanders who had participated. But he was able to not just achieve the protectorate status, I believe, of Southwest Africa for South Africa, but he was also able to use the ideas of South Africans to shape the post-war order. And even though the League of Nations ultimately failed, it was still the dominant model for the United Nations that followed. So, you know, what is Ramaphosa bringing to the table? What achievements has he brought with him? What has South Africa done under Ramaphosa's leadership that would back up his claims to any kind of presence on the world stage? I mean, if anything, South Africa's moved backwards and he's tolerated because he's seen as the best of a bad lot. But South Africa does have the alternative. I guess that's where the analogy does hold, is that you have a strong opposition project that has been headed by some very good people, some very determined people with ideas and not just appeals to group membership and that sort of thing. So, you know, there could be a change brewing in South Africa, but maybe we'll see, as you point out, as we've seen before, maybe we'll see that change from within the ruling party before it reaches the ballot box.
So what's the best case scenario for South Africans? You've got family here, you've got friends here, you know the country well. You have to be feeling for them, for farmers, for industrialists, for exporters. Many are already on the brink after 15 bad years of the economy. What's the best case?
You know, I live in a place that's governed very much like South Africa's governed. I'm from California. I've been there for 15 years. And California keeps electing the same people who do the same bad job. I mean, I have seen California go downhill since moving there, and very little has improved. I mean, you can point to one or two things. I used to say, well, at least they can't ruin the mountains and the ocean, and now they've done that as well because of the wildfires and the toxicity and the pollution and so forth, which will take quite some time to remove. And there are some encouraging signs of rebuilding, but not because of the government, because the neighbors and the communities have pulled together and done things in spite of the government, not because of it. So, you know, it's a question that faces any country or any province that has a single party that dominates for so long, and that dominates for so long that the voters who would choose an alternative eventually leave. I mean, that's the problem in California, is that the Republican voter base that might otherwise challenge the dominance of the Democratic Party is simply emigrating to other states that have lower taxes, lower cost of living, better schools, better infrastructure, more of a sense of inclusion in government. They don't want to wait forever. They don't want to wait for the next election for things to improve. And so, you know, what do you do? I mean, unfortunately, it takes sometimes a much bigger catastrophe to awaken people to the need for change. Now, it could be these wildfires are the trigger in California. I don't know if these tariffs will be the same in South Africa, but I said at the time of the Ramaphosa meeting, it was really an opportunity for South Africa. The fact that Donald Trump rebuked the South African president in front of the whole world and said, look, you've got to get a handle on crime and violence, and that even South Africans who thought Ramaphosa was great or felt the need to say that he had done a good job admitted that crime is a real problem. I mean, the best defense in the meeting with Trump that was offered by the head of the trade unions, who said, yes, well, you know, it's not a white genocide. Everybody's getting killed. Well, okay. You know, there was a public acknowledgement, at least, of the problem of public safety in South Africa, which, in my experience, the South African government has been really at pains to underplay or downplay. So it was an opportunity for South Africa. I mean, I don't know how California really can turn things around unless it's through a confrontation with the Trump administration, which is brewing, by the way. California is short of money. It has a big budget deficit, and it's already had to cut services and looking at various other restructuring priorities because the Trump administration is not going to bail them out the way the Biden administration did. Los Angeles has a $1 billion deficit. San Francisco has a $1 billion deficit. And Los Angeles has to host the Olympics in 3 years, as well as the World Cup pretty soon. So, you know, the force for change may come from a confrontation with Trump. And the same may be true with South Africa, that sometimes you need tough love to get things together. So maybe this 30% tariff, and again, I believe it's going to be 40% if you add in the BRICS surcharge. I think it could be something that spurs change in South Africa. And as you mentioned, maybe it will. Maybe it'll come in a different form. Maybe it'll come through one of the ruling party recalls that have happened before. But I do think that if you have the right leadership that can step up, if there are alternative leaders who can really make the case, then there's a huge opportunity. In California, we don't have that yet. We do have an election next year, but we haven't yet seen a candidate emerge who can really compete for power. We'll see. There's no favorite yet, even in the dominant Democratic Party. So there is the possibility of a surprise. South Africa is a bit trickier because you do have opposition voices that are very loud, but not necessarily very productive on the fringes. And maybe those fringes are stronger now. I don't know. But we'll see. I think the confrontation could work out for the best.
So if the DA were to consult to you, how would you advise them right now? Because there's a lot of confusion as well that's going on within that party. Should we remain part of the GNU? Should we leave, etc.? They are very confused. And the messaging that's coming out now is, well, there might be confrontation coming just in the next little while. There's a lot of tension around that. What would you recommend to them?
Many lifetimes ago, when I worked as a speechwriter in the DA, I worked around some incredibly politically talented people. And at the time, Tony Leon was the leader of the opposition, and I worked for him directly. And one of the things I learned from Tony is that even if you encounter opposition or criticism, you need to put clear blue water between yourself and your political opponents. And the fact that you're encountering arguments and criticism and even abuse is a sign that you're probably doing things the right way. You need to offer voters a clear alternative. The danger of going into the GNU for the DA was always that it would confuse the voters, that the DA would be on the hook for everything the ANC did wrong. And I don't think the DA negotiated well from a distance, okay? I'm making judgments from a distance, but I don't think the DA negotiated well from a distance with the ANC. I think the DA got less than it earned in the election in terms of ministries and responsibility. I mean, the public face of South Africa is still the ANC. The ANC is guiding foreign policy. How do you bring the ANC below 50% and still let them run the country as if they represent South Africa? You know, often when I'll criticize South Africa's policies, I'll have responses on X saying, well, they don't represent all of South Africa, but they actually do. And the DA didn't get the foreign ministry, you know. So, you know, what did the DA get that really gave it any kind of leverage in this government or any kind of ability to create change? So I think the DA needs to say they went into this government showing the South African voter that they were willing to do anything and work with any responsible party at trying to make things better, but it turns out the ANC is not, and that the ANC is simply interested in power for power's sake, and whatever it is that motivates them is not good for South Africa, and it's time for an alternative. And I think the DA needs to establish that clear blue water. It is a difficult choice because there are some very nasty opposition parties on the fringes who could exploit any kind of chaos for their own purposes, and the ANC could invite them into government to replace the DA and so forth. But I think you need to face that situation, and it's easy for me to say again from a relatively comfortable distance, but I think it is better to be hated than loved, because when people feel very strongly about you, even if they feel very strongly against you, they're more likely to support you in the end once they're convinced what you're doing is right. It's when people feel sort of lukewarm about you, that they're neither motivated for or against you, that's when you have to worry that you're not actually reaching them. And so you need to present a clear alternative, even if it's one that is difficult at first to defend. I think that's the DA's best strategy. That's what I would tell them to do. And I tell them to stop trying to represent South Africa when they have no say in South Africa's policies. I mean, or almost none. I mean, did the DA review the South African decision to sign the book of condolence at the Iranian embassy? I mean, who were they expressing condolences for? The terrorist generals that were wiped out by Israeli intelligence? I mean, it's ludicrous, actually. I mean, these Iranian generals should have been, you know, arrested and tried for war crimes. And since you can't do that, and they're members of an opposing military, I guess they died the way they lived, by the sword. Do they deserve condolences? I mean, it's so ridiculous. And, you know, and the South African government claims to represent human rights and the best of humanity, and they're in The Hague, and they're, you know, arguing against Israel at the ICJ. I mean, it's so silly and self-defeating. So why doesn't the DA get to stop that? I mean, it's so bad for the country. And, you know, now there's a 10% BRICS surcharge. So, I mean, why is South Africa part of BRICS? What's the purpose of BRICS? It just antagonizes the United States. Is that good? I mean, Russia does that pretty well all on its own. China does it quietly and very effectively simply by investing in itself and lending the United States money and feeding our fentanyl habit as well as our habit of debt spending, which is, you know, it's a close race as to which is the more destructive. So it's a very serious rivalry, but they don't need South Africa to do that. Why is South Africa pushing this idea? I think South Africa's political elite, particularly in the ANC, is wedded to the idea of a bipolar world. They're desperate to recreate the Soviet Union from the ashes of the dustbin of history. And I think it's a wasted effort, and it probably costs South Africa a lot in terms of economic growth and opportunity. Speaking of which, I saw the headlines, I actually wrote a story about this. The massive amount of South Africa's GDP that is devoted to online sports betting is incredible. I mean, I maybe an overestimate because people tend to roll over their winnings into new bets, but it's a massive, massive percentage of the economy. I mean, that's not economic investment. That's taking South Africa backwards. So why, you know, the ANC, I often felt when I lived in South Africa, the ANC had a lottery mentality. I'm not against lotteries, by the way, but there was a lottery mentality that, you know, as long as we let one person win once in a while, everybody will believe in the model. But that's not how you build a society. A society is built from the ground up. And, you know, that's what gives me encouragement when I look at California, because when I look at the people we elect, it's very discouraging. But when I look at the people around me in my community and how they behave and how they lead and how they pull things together and how they actually make things work, then I'm very happy that I'm from California. So, you know, do you want a lottery mentality or do you want a growth mentality? And I think, you know, politicians like the lottery mentality for various reasons, but I think South Africans, ordinary South Africans, are getting too into it, and it has a financial impact on households and individual lives. People don't believe in growth, but they still want wealth. So how do you reach it? I mean, this idea that South Africa is going to sort of leapfrog the United States by aligning with the bad guys of the world, it's like playing into a terrible gambling game that you know you can't win. So maybe there's, you know, maybe I've overstretched the connection, but I do think there's this idea that somehow if you keep making bad bets, you'll make all your winnings back. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, there's a saying that Bobby Godsell referred some time ago where he said South Africa has always been a country that has been blessed by its people and cursed by its governors. It appears as though California is in a similar situation. Joel, just to close off with, the DA went into the government of national unity knowing that it had to make the economy work. It had to grow economic growth for the GNU to have any chance of being viewed as a success, and as a consequence, its members benefiting politically in the next election. These tariffs are certainly not doing that. We've heard that Mercedes-Benz are now considering leaving the country, and with a 30, 40% tariff, the other motor manufacturers are just not going to be viable if a big chunk of their products are sold into the United States, which they are, to say nothing of many of the other parts of the economy where mass unemployment is likely to come. Would that not be the major factor now? Now that the Trump isn't going to, he's going to play hardball here, it appears. Maybe you can tell us about the taco trade as well, just to close off with. But would that not, if you were in a political party, would that not be a massive motivating factor right now?
You know, the taco trade, I mean, the idea that Trump always chickens out. You know, I think that was always a bad bet, and I think the Iranians learned that the hard way. I think that Trump means what he says, and I think he backed away from imposing the highest level of tariffs because the bond market was telling him that he couldn't really do that. So, you know, I think it was Tom Friedman or somebody who said once that, you know, when they're reincarnated, they want to come back as the bond market because the bond market scares everybody. But, you know, even the United States is subject to the constraints of global finance and the markets and so forth. But I think that the key to growth in South Africa is, you know, let's come back to that idea. You have to get rid of the lottery mentality and replace it with a growth mentality. And BEE is a lottery policy. Why? Because it reserves a place, 25 or 30%, for Black individuals. And it says these individuals will be allowed to enter the promised land of luxury, of comfort, of Houghton and Sandton and Bishop's Court and high walls and luxury automobiles and private schools. And even if it harms everybody else, if it takes productive capital out of the economy, if it causes skilled people to emigrate, if it keeps foreign investment away, if it prevents products and services from being introduced into the South African economy that could help everybody, most of all Black South Africans, if it destroys public services, if it destroys the schools, if it holds back the things that people depend on most, especially the poor, we're willing to accept that as long as that narrow elite slice includes 30% of the historically disadvantaged individuals or whatever in its number. That's a lottery mentality. It's not a growth mentality. First of all, why stop at 30%? I mean, in a growing economy, there's no reason for any kind of racial quotas. And the quotas become a ceiling rather than a floor. And secondly, I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, it's absurd that Starlink wouldn't be allowed. And I'm not, you know, I hold no brief for Elon Musk, and, you know, he's had his ups and downs. But it's absurd that a service that is so obviously beneficial to people would be kept out of the country. And then the idea, I can't remember which minister who said it, but the idea that there's some kind of Chinese alternative that'll be forthcoming one day and we can look forward to the Chinese version rather than the American version. I mean, okay, if China comes out with a competing product, you can switch, but there is no competing product. So why would you do that just for ideological reasons and political reasons? I mean, again, it's a lottery mentality, and it's this idea of trying to resurrect the Soviet Union. And, you know, when that's a vision that the ruling party, and I think the ANC is, for all intents and purposes, still the ruling party, I think when that's a vision that they cling to long after it's ceased to function, then maybe the voters do say, look, we've had enough. But it has to be a cultural shift as well as a political one. And that's probably true of California as well, by the way. I mean, one of the reasons Democrats keep getting reelected in California is they're often able to fight culture wars against Republicans. They say Republicans are these nasty religious types who don't want to let us have our gay marriages and our abortions and whatever. And that works, actually. It works for many Californians. But it's not good for the state. And the reason the state stays afloat is it has good weather and attracts talented people, and there's still a critical mass of technological talent in Silicon Valley, but it's rapidly getting poached by other places. And you need a cultural shift before people really start to think differently. So maybe it'll happen.
Fascinating parallels. Thank you, Joel Pottock, senior editor at Breitbart. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.